Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Alan Gura for the appellants, and I'm joined at counsel table by Thomas Huff. The government contends that Jefferson Wayne Schrader is prohibited from possessing firearms by virtue of his common law misdemeanor assault conviction, and moreover, the government also claims that the Second Amendment, which codifies the right to arms, as it was understood in the 18th century, would not provide him any relief from this disability. Neither of these propositions is correct. We begin, and given the canon of constitutional avoidance, we should probably end with the plain text of the statute and its structure. Common law misdemeanor assault is simply not a crime punishable by a term exceeding 1 year. The term punishable is not defined by statute, and it should therefore be given its ordinary meaning consistent with its purpose and placement in the overall statutory scheme.
But it would have been so easy for Congress to have used the word punished to have made the statute read the way you want it to.
That's correct. Had the Congress used the word punished, right, then Mr. Schrader would clearly not be included within the statute.
Right. But punishable has a completely different meaning.
That's correct. Punishable can mean, and in fact we contend that it does mean, subject to a specific punishment. That's a definition offered by Black's Law Dictionary.
A statute that says punishable by a term up to life imprisonment, right? That's not specific.
Even then, Your Honor, I would contend that there would have to be some definition in the statute. The statutory text would look to a state legislative judgment. The state legislature has actually imposed a particular sentencing range, whether it's...
Let me ask a slightly different question. Suppose Schrader had been convicted under a statute in 1968 under the exact same circumstances, and it had allowed a punishment of 2 years or more, and he had led an absolutely blameless life in the 44 years since then. Would you have a materially weaker case?
We would have a materially different case, Your Honor.
I
would not say the case is materially weaker, because one thing that is, we think, equally obvious. First of all, at that point, there would not be a statutory problem, because under Your Honor's hypothetical, there would be a specific statute that would implicate 922G1, but we would definitely have a constitutional problem, because at that point we would look to see whether or not the imposition of a lifetime complete firearms disability under those particular circumstances comports with the Second Amendment's protection. Virtually every circuit that has contemplated that type of case has stated, albeit in dicta, but nonetheless stated, that even 922G1 is subject to an as-applied hypothetical challenge under the facts that, for example, the North Carolina Supreme Court found persuasive in the Britt case, where you had a very old felony conviction for drug distribution, but the individual had led a blameless...
I don't understand how you draw the line. If you say a lifetime bar would be unconstitutional, what about a 10-year bar? Or a 5-year bar, or a 15-year bar, or a 25-year bar? But what's the constitutional principle that tells us that something is too long?
The constitutional principle, Your Honor, actually some of those types of examples might well be constitutional, and in fact there are states
that impose. What's the test, though?
The test is to see whether or not there is under an appropriate means ends level of scrutiny, and in this case we would contend that it's strict scrutiny, whether or not the particular disability that's contemplated is one that passes muster. In a case of a 5-year ban, for example, we could say that there had been a recent act of violence that brings into some question whether or not there's a propensity for violence. It's not perhaps the most serious transgression that the law knows, but it's appropriate perhaps for somebody to suffer at least a temporary disability. But in contrast, somebody who has a habitual a persistent record of violence, somebody who is a repeat offender, the law might treat very differently because they would be understood to pose a different risk.
See, I don't really understand that as a test. But since you've brought it up, I have another question. Can you tell me where in the complaint the argument or the allegation supporting your current argument is? I've read your complaint. I've read the district court opinion, and I don't see an argument based on the particular circumstances of Mr. Schrader. There is a so-called as-applied, but it's as-applied to common law misdemeanors in general. And the district court dealt with the sort of argument you're mounting now, that your client has led a non-criminal, non-violent, peaceful life ever since 1968. Rather, the argument by the organization and by Mr. Schrader in the complaint was that it, as applied to common law misdemeanors, the statute's unconstitutional.
Your Honor, the argument that Your Honor sees in our complaint is indeed our argument. I was merely responding to Judge Williams' suggestion that there might be hypothetical situations where, and courts have recognized, the particular circumstances are such that we can say that the as-applied challenge is based upon particular circumstances. However, we can say that categorically, as a rule, we know that misdemeanants of common law were never disarmed, going back to the 18th century. We know that misdemeanants are not...
So is your answer to Judge Randolph, are you saying then that if we don't accept your argument that the statute doesn't include common law misdemeanors, that you're not also arguing that even if it does, it can't be extended to people like your client?
We're making both. Our primary argument is we do have several arguments. The first argument we have is, of course, the statute does not cover this act. The second argument would be, even if it were to cover this act, the fact is that under the Second Amendment, we know that historically there is no longstanding tradition of disarming common law misdemeanants. This is not something that has long-standing public acceptance, the very application of 922G1.
I understand. The other problem I have with your argument about excluding common law misdemeanors is that under Maryland law, common law misdemeanors can include some pretty violent offenses. You realize that?
Your Honor, I realize that. However, what I would say is, first of all,
here's a case I found from, here's a case from the 60s, a Maryland court case where a person gets 20 years for a pretty vicious assault. And the court goes on in this case, it's called Walker versus State. The court goes on to explain that under Maryland law, a common law misdemeanor can be often much more serious than a statutory felony.
Honor,
so under your theory, these people would be excluded, correct?
Not necessarily.
No?
As a statutory matter, the statute is what Congress gave us, and there's only so much we can do with it. As a doctrinal matter under the Second Amendment, Your Honor, we concede and fully, cheerfully admit that people convicted of seriously aggravated misdemeanors, for example, misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence, those are punished properly under 922G9.
I thought under this statute, you would define the definition of misdemeanor here to exclude common law misdemeanors, right? So any misdemeanor not covered by the specific provisions of 92G would be, like, for example, the one I just gave you.
Okay.
Is
a statutory matter, perhaps Congress should revisit this and perhaps come up with a better, with a more precise and accurate statute. And that's happened before, for example, in Bailey. The Supreme Court was faced with the question of what does it mean to use a gun during the commission of a crime? And the Supreme Court found that the term use means the gun has to be actually employed, and the fact that the mere possession of a gun existed, that wasn't enough to tack on a sentence. Well, Congress went back and they toughened up the law. They clarified it, and so that particular decision was superseded by statute. In Maryland law, Your Honor, the Maryland legislature imposes a disability, a firearms disability, only upon statutory assaults, and they've excluded.
Suppose I were to agree with you about your constitutional avoidance argument. Suppose I would agree with you that applying the statute to a person like your client could raise serious constitutional questions, but that I don't buy your argument that we can, that there's any way we can interpret this statute because of its language to exclude common law misdemeanors. What do we do?
At that point, then the court has to reach the constitutional issue. I mean, the constitutional avoidance doctrine only goes so far. If the statutory argument does not convince the court, then we have the constitutional argument there. And
Could we? What about 925C?
925C, is your Honor referring to the ATF's process of? Well, that was defunded by Congress.
It was defunded, but it's still in the statute.
There's nothing we can act. In fact, it was an interesting case in the circuit dealing with a similar defunding of a similar provision under the Transportation Act. And the court, there was an interesting argument made to the district court in that case, American Bus, that there was a defunding a relief provision violates the First Amendment right to petition, and that was reversed by this court. So there's nothing we can do with 925C. I agree with Your Honor that if 925C were fully funded by Congress, that would eliminate the need for courts to deal with these kinds of cases.
No, I wasn't suggesting that the answer is for you, your client, to apply under 925C. I agree you can't do that now. But could we remand this to the district court to hold a 925C hearing?
I don't read the statute to
avoid the constitutional problem.
I'm not sure that the court could do that, Your Honor. The 925C contemplates, as a first pass, that there's an administrative process handled by the federal government, and only then we...
Well, the Bean case, I think, stands against that, doesn't it?
Which case, Your Honor?
Bean.
U.S. v. Bean.
Yeah. Bean. Mm-hmm. Your Honor, we have not... This is not something that's come up, but obviously we would be happy with
anything. Do you know why Congress has not funded BATF?
It's a political decision by the Congress.
Is it because it's too cumbersome and too time-consuming to conduct these investigations?
No, my understanding is that 925C functioned quite well for a number of years, and I've met people who've actually benefited from it. My understanding is that certain members of Congress simply don't want people to enjoy Second Amendment rights, and this was a way to shut off a valve of people having relief.
So, essentially what you're asking for, and I don't want to come back to this, is for the courts to take over that function, to consider the particular circumstances of each individual who has an otherwise disqualifying conviction and determine whether, because of those circumstances, they should nevertheless be allowed to possess a firearm.
Your Honor, the court is in the business of resolving constitutional claims, and when the government
Do we have any idea what are we talking about here? Hundreds of thousands?
Well, the easy solution, Your Honor, if the court is concerned with its workload, of course, is to say this is simply not within the statute, and if Congress wants to write a more precise statute, then perhaps we could have another go of it.
I want to get back to your answer to Judge Tatel on one point. You started saying that we have a number of arguments, and as I understand, you got as far as the second argument. You said the first argument is statutory.
That's correct.
The second argument is that if the statute does cover common law misdemeanors, it's unconstitutional under the Second Amendment. Do you have a third argument, too?
Well, Your Honor.
Is the third argument the one we see I thought I saw in the brief, and this is what I asked you before, that even if the statute applies, even if common law misdemeanors are not a violation of the Second Amendment, nevertheless, because of the particular circumstances of my individual client, it's unconstitutional to apply this ban to him.
Courts have recognized that.
Is that one of your arguments?
That is an argument that we're making.
So I get back to the point that I asked you a while ago. Where is anything of that sort alleged in your complaint?
Your Honor,
I can't find it.
Your Honor, that specific theory of the case is not one that's specifically elucidated in the complaint.
I didn't think so. And I don't find it addressed in the district court opinion either.
Your Honor,
unless you have another view of it, I've looked twice.
The district court did not think to go that far. However,
was it argued before the district court?
This case was not argued. This was something we submitted on the papers, and the papers are what
they are. Did the papers raise this point?
I'd have to look, Your Honor. I haven't read those papers recently, but I believe that it was something that is.
If I can indulge you in one more question,
sure.
Before I know my colleagues have. Are you quite certain that Georgia law would allow your client to possess a firearm?
That is our understanding of Georgia law. We've researched the matter, and my understanding is that there's a Georgia Supreme Court opinion that does not. First of all, the Georgia statute uses the same kind of language here, about the 1 year.
Punishable by, yeah.
That's right, but they don't extend to out-of-state misdemeanor convictions, and this is an out-of-state misdemeanor conviction for Georgia law.
Well, there is that the case you're relying on and cited in the reply brief, I believe, put that holding on the basis of failure to give notice and construing a criminal statute in a manner favorable to a particular defendant there. But if I'm not sure whether that applies if, for example, on behalf of your client, you sought a declaratory judgment ahead of time to determine.
My client's lived in Georgia for many years, and he's had firearms. He's gone through background checks, and the state has never interfered with his ability to have firearms. And I would presume that they have the same access to the NICS background check and the same criminal record history that the federal government located in Maryland.
He has firearms now?
No, he does not. He doesn't have them now because the way this started is he was going to acquire an additional firearm, and they told him he was prohibited. He was visited by – this isn't the complaint. He was visited by an ATF agent, told him to surrender his firearms, and he did. So he does not have firearms now. He definitely is complying with the law. He would not violate the law knowingly.
One more question about the statute. Judge Randolph was asking why Congress defunded 925C. I think one of the reasons was it thought that 921A20 would be adequate to protect people like your client, which says that convictions for misdemeanors don't include the word conviction doesn't include any conviction which has been expunged, set aside, or pardoned.
Well, Your Honor, the fact is that Congress does things for whatever reason. It defunded.
No, this is in the statute. I'm asking why that provision, which excludes from the definition of conviction people who have been pardoned or whose convictions have been set aside.
Seeking a gubernatorial pardon is a far more involved and far-fetched idea than to seek a precise administrative review by the federal law enforcement apparatus that's specifically designed to deal with firearms. 925C gives a definitely a better result. What we do know, however, is that when Congress repealed or defunded 925C, Your Honor, they were not thinking about the Second Amendment.
Right.
This was pre-Heller. This was pre-McDonald. The Second Amendment was definitely not something that I believe it was Senator Schumer who proposed that particular provision defunding 925C. And as a matter of the kind of injury that our client has here, the injury is completed by the fact that he's been disarmed by the federal government. The injury is not something that depends upon the possible, perhaps, ability to get relief from some other manner. The injury was completed upon the time in which he received his NICS denial. I see I'm way over time.
Yeah, I have just one question. Do we have any record as to how many applications there were under 925C in the period when it was funded?
No, Your Honor.
Perhaps the government could help us on that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anisha Desgupta for the appellees. I'd like to start with the statutory argument that Mr. Schrader is making, his point about the term punishable. That was foreclosed by the Supreme Court's comments in Dickerson, where the Supreme Court noted that in 922G, Congress focused on the term by which an offense was punishable, not the actual punishment imposed. And Mr. Schrader's argument would apply equally to all common law offenses, not just common law misdemeanor offenses. In essence, he seeks to inject a limitation into the statute that the plain language doesn't allow for. Here, his complaint acknowledges that he was convicted of simple assault by a Maryland court. And there's no dispute that the court could have sentenced him to a term exceeding 2 years, or that the Maryland Supreme Court had upheld sentences of up to 20 years at the time of his conviction. His reliance on the Schultheis case is unavailing because that focused on the same definition of punishable that was rejected by the Supreme Court in Dickerson. As to Mr. Schrader's constitutional arguments, the first issue here deals with the question of whether the Second Amendment even applies. The Heller case dealt with the right of law-abiding responsible citizens to self-defense in the home.
Yeah, and why isn't that this person? It says, the right, this is a language from Heller, if the amendment protects anything, it protects, quote, the right of law-abiding citizens to use arms, defense of hearth and homes. This, why isn't there a serious constitutional problem in applying this statute to a person like this?
Well, 2 points, Your Honor. First, 922 G1 applies only to persons with certain prior convictions, so that it is not anyone who's ever been convicted of any sort of infraction.
Well, I asked you about this particular person who was convicted of a common law misdemeanor, sentenced to no prison time, right? And has served and has apparently lived a perfectly respectable life, including serving in Vietnam, where I assume he carried a weapon in a U.S. uniform, U.S. military uniform, right?
Well, so he was convicted of a serious offense under the law that could have been punished by a term up to what was allowed by the Eighth Amendment, and certainly people convicted of the same offense in his jurisdiction.
I was asking you the constitutional question. Well, not the statutory question. I know, I got your argument about the statute.
Well, that also applies as a constitutional matter, Your Honor. In determining what the original scope of the Second Amendment was, the Supreme Court in Heller looked to what it termed influential precursors to the Second Amendment. And those note that the pre-existing right that was codified by the Second Amendment was understood to be reserved to peaceable citizens. In some cases,
that leaves open the question of how a peaceable citizen is defined.
Yes, Your Honor, but the question of whether someone who has been convicted of an offense that involved actual violence, that under the law of the state could have received a sentence
the conviction had been expunged, would it be? It had been expunged precisely on the ground that in the decades since the conviction, the person convicted had lived a fine life. There'd be no, I know the statute covers it, but there'd be no constitutional problem there?
Well, there, Your Honor, if the conviction had been expunged, then the 922 G1 prohibition would not apply.
I just said that. I'm giving you the hypothetical where 922 G1 doesn't exist. Okay? So no constitutional problem, on your view, I take it.
No, Your Honor, because if Mr. Schrader wasn't under the disqualification, we wouldn't be here.
Please take 922 G out of the case, G1 out of the case, okay? Or maybe it's 8, I'm sorry. 20.
920, 821, 820,
yes. the pardon 20. Provision in any event. Take that out of the case. Take it out of the statute books. And suppose that we have a person whose conviction has been expunged because of a pardon for the reasons that I gave. Take that hypothetical. It is a hypothetical. And say how you view the Constitution as applying to it.
Well, there would be no constitutional problem there, because if Congress, as a matter of grace, chooses to allow certain individuals...
This is a hypothetical. This assumes statutes, a statutory pattern different from what we have. It assumes no exception for pardons, okay? Right? And we have a person who has been pardoned on the grounds that I gave. And what I'm trying to find out is your position on the application of the Constitution to that set of hypothetical facts.
There would be no constitutional problem there, Your Honor. So under Your Honor's hypothetical, Congress does not have that exception. So we're talking about an individual who's received the expungement under state law, but it still falls within the 922 G1 prohibition because, again, under Your Honor's hypothetical, there's no carve-out,
right,
correct?
Right.
So under that circumstance, that individual would be disqualified from possessing a firearm under
That's
federal law.
Statutory result.
Correct, but there would be no constitutional problem with that, Your Honor, because that individual falls within 922 G1 because of a prior offense. So the state.
So you think that when the Supreme Court makes it clear that it's all right for Congress and other legislative bodies to exclude non-peaceable citizens, that the legislatures can define non-peaceable any way they like. Is that correct? Is that your position?
No, Your Honor. Obviously, the Supreme Court has told us that the original understanding of the Second Amendment should guide the analysis.
Okay.
And it's the government's understanding that persons who've been convicted of violent offenses for which a jurisdiction might impose serious sentences are persons who, under the pre-existing right, could have had their...
Do you have any cases from the period before the Second Amendment blossomed indicating that that was the, or more particularly, life in 1789, that was what states were doing?
Well, there are a number of sources that guide the analysis. So the first are the precursors to the Second Amendment that I mentioned earlier.
These precursors, do you have any indication that the hypothetical that I gave you is one which would result in denial of right to carry arms?
Well, the hypothetical that Your Honor provided presumably encompasses someone who was convicted of the same kind of offense as Mr. Schrader, so an offense involving violence in a serious sentence. Right? So in order to fall within 922 G1, an individual has to have been convicted of certain kinds of offenses. So an offense, Congress determined that certain antitrust violations, other offenses wouldn't qualify. So here we're talking about persons who fall within the statute because their offenses are of the type of serious nature that Congress determined their possession of a firearm would have concerns for public safety. And this court in Parker noted that that was entirely consistent with the Second Amendment right as originally understood. So in Parker, this court cited a number of examples of restrictions that at common law coexisted with the right to bear arms that preceded the Second Amendment. And the court noted that those types of restrictions are the kinds that were contemplated by the drafters of the Second Amendment as consistent with the Second Amendment right, meaning that for a legislative body to impose those restrictions doesn't raise Second Amendment concerns. And the court, this court in Parker, listed a couple of examples and noted that the common ground that those examples involved was that they promote the government's interest in public safety consistent with our common law tradition. And
what if you come upon a set of facts where they don't promote that interest at all?
Well,
which seems to be the case in my hypothetical.
Your Honor, in this circumstance, we're talking about an individual who can't fall within the description of law-abiding and responsible based on his prior offense. So, Your Honor's hypothetical.
So once you're convicted of a misdemeanor of violence, say in your teens, when you get to be 80, you still can't be considered a law-abiding citizen? I find that rather astonishing.
Well, I'm not sure how this affects the terms of Your Honor's hypothetical, but many states treat juvenile offenses differently from adult offenses.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, the statute doesn't, maybe the statute does, I haven't checked it out on this, draw that distinction.
But the key point, Your Honor, is that it's not any individual who's convicted of any misdemeanor offense, or even any individual who's convicted of any misdemeanor offense involving violence. A person wouldn't fall within the 922 G1 prohibition unless the offense was one that was punishable by more than 2 years.
When was that statute passed?
The original statute was part of the 1968 Gun Control Act, Your Honor.
So it was passed after this individual, Mr. Schroeder, committed his common law assault?
My understanding from the district court's opinion, I'm not quite sure of how the months track, but I think the district court commented that it was contemporaneous with Mr. Schroeder's offense.
Well, it was I think the statute was passed in December, so I guess if Mr. Schroeder committed the offense sometime after that. But I just wondered about the ex post facto implications that Congress has, in effect, imposed a penalty on somebody for a crime after they commit it.
Well, again, Your Honor, this isn't a penalty, and we're not talking about a crime here with respect to Mr. Schroeder. He's not being prosecuted for the offense, and he's not being prosecuted for anything he did. He's not being prosecuted for anything he did before the effective date of the statute. The only thing that happened before the effective date of the statute, perhaps, is that he committed the offense conduct that puts him within the realm of Congress's judgment that he is the type of person.
Do you agree that it's clear under Georgia law that he can possess firearms? You haven't contested that, right?
Well, the government's understanding is that it's not clear. I believe for the reasons that Your Honor pointed out, there's on the one hand a Georgia Supreme Court case that because of the way the term felony is used in the Georgia statute expresses concern about criminally prosecuting someone whose qualifying offense was a misdemeanor offense. But as to the status of the disqualification under Georgia law, that remains an open question and wasn't something developed in district court in this case.
If he were disqualified under Georgia law, would he? What effect would that have on this case?
Well, that would render this court unable to grant him any relief, because even if the federal disqualification doesn't apply, he would still be prohibited under Georgia law.
Do you know whether Georgia has a provision like California where federal courts can refer state law questions to the Supreme Court of Georgia?
I do not, Your Honor. Again, that issue wasn't developed below.
He's not confined to Georgia for the rest of his life. You say that a federal court couldn't give relief, but it would enable him to go to a state where, assuming the worst in Georgia, he could carry arms.
Well, Congress here pegged the determination to the seriousness of the offense, which it believed was best judged by the state of conviction.
I'm going to the question of whether the court could give relief.
Well, Your Honor, there are a number of states that have statutes that would independently bar someone convicted of Mr. Schroeder's offense.
Mr. Schroeder might not go to them.
Will you don't? I want to ask you about 925C. I know it's Congress hasn't funded in recent years, but isn't 925C pretty powerful evidence in this statute that Congress actually intended people like Schroeder not to be barred from owning weapons?
Well, the existence of 925C shows that Congress was prepared to, the Congress that enacted that statute was prepared to provide some mitigating measures.
That means the answer to my question is yes.
Yes, but to clarify, Your Honor, that's not a constitutional requirement.
No, it's not. Well, that was going to be my next question. You know, when Congress defunded 925, Heller hadn't been decided, nor had Heller been decided when the Supreme Court decided Bean. So my question is, if we think there is a constitution, could be a constitutional problem here, why isn't the, do we have the ability to have the district court essentially make a 925C type judgment about this particular plaintiff to avoid the constitutional problem?
No, Your Honor, because
particularly since it would be so consistent with congressional intent.
Well, first of all, the Congress has defunded that, showing that it doesn't intend to.
There's lots of cases, including from the Supreme Court, which say that you can't disregard substantive law just because of what happens in an appropriation bill. It's still law. And they mean that the agency can't process applications on it. But that statute, that provision is still in the statute. It's still part of the statute.
And still being operated, because the defunding was only partial. Corporations can still take advantage of 925C. Individuals can't.
Well, the problem would be, Your Honor, that there are no constitutional guideposts for that type of analysis. So here, the court would be proceeding with caution.
I just gave you one.
Constitutional
avoidance doctrine. To avoid having to wrestle with the difficult question of whether this statute can be constitutionally applied to people like Schrader, we just invoke the procedure that Congress itself approved, namely looking person by person to see whether or not, I don't know, maybe, yeah, sure, it might result in a lot of cases, but it might also inspire Congress to realize that maybe it should fund this provision to protect the constitutionality of the statute.
Well, Your Honor, that would be contrary to the intentions of Congress when Congress defunded it. But more to the point, so for this court,
the only thing Congress said is that the agency can't process applications. That's all the Congress said. They didn't give the agency. They said the agency, you don't have any money to process it. It didn't say anything about whether or not the courts can use 925C as an indicator of congressional intent.
Well, what it would be judicially injecting a remedy into a situation where Congress said what remedy it wanted and then determined that on second thought that remedy wasn't an appropriate remedy. So
have you read the Supreme Court's decision in Northwest Austin?
I have not, Your Honor.
Okay.
The Attorney General delegated the authority to BATF, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
BATF was moved over in the Homeland Security Act, I think, from Treasury to the Attorney General. And then the Attorney General delegated. What if the Attorney General revoked the delegation? The statute talks about the Attorney General making these judgments. And the lack of funding is to BATF. What would prevent the Attorney General from conducting these reviews then?
Well,
if the Attorney General simply revoked the delegation to BATF?
Well, again, this court would be, to some extent, creating the remedy out of whole cloth. I understand that
I'm not talking about this court doing anything. I'm talking about the Attorney General solving the problem by revoking the authority of the delegation to BATF.
Well, Your Honor, that would be contrary to the intention of Congress. And also, if it's motivated by this court's constitutional concerns, then the court should be guided by Heller's language and analysis. And Heller, when it noted that felons could be disqualified from possessing arms, didn't say anything about a time bar, and the original sources don't either. So
when Justice Department submitted its budget request, did it request funding for BATF to conduct 925C hearings?
Again, Your Honor, I don't know. This wasn't an issue that was developed in this case at all, so there hasn't been any discussion about the appropriateness or non-appropriateness of a 925C remedy. As a structural matter, it would seem that, you know, because Congress has made clear that that is not part of the statute, for this court to create a judicial remedy that tracks that would still be to read a judicial remedy into a statute where.
But you see, your answer to our questions about this, if we in fact have serious constitutional doubts, you're leaving us no option other than to declare unconstitutional as applied to people like him.
Well,
what we're trying to do in these questions is find out from you whether, if we disagree with you, I know you don't think that there's a constitutional problem here, but if we think there is one, you're leaving us with no option other than to invalidate the statute as applied.
Well,
right?
The court would not be able to invalidate the statute as applied to Mr. Schrader without also invalidating it as to individuals who've committed serious offenses.
I don't accept Schrader's argument that we can interpret the statute to limit it to exclude common law misdemeanors. Let's just assume I don't agree with that. For the reason you just gave. You see, then you've left us with no option.
Well, Your Honor, the common law misdemeanors. So the principles on which this court would be looking to evaluate the constitutionality as to Mr. Schrader are principles that apply to other individuals convicted of serious and violent offenses.
No, not at all. They wouldn't. It would only apply. It would be a 925C type. It would only apply. The people who would be excluded would be people who committed minor crimes and minor offenses, and through their lives and the way they've lived their lives have demonstrated that they're responsible citizens.
But again, there's no constitutional guidepost to guide this court's analysis. What does it mean
The constitutional guidepost is that we think, and I'm only speaking for myself here, that there may be a serious constitutional problem that we need to avoid. And you're giving us no option for doing that. None. In other words, if we think this can't be applied to people like Schrader constitutionally, because it's essentially, you know, they are, people like this can demonstrate that they are eligible to benefit from this constitutional right. If we think that, and if you're telling us there's no way statutorily we can invoke the principles of 925C to avoid that constitutional problem, you're leaving us no choice.
But
to resolve the constitutional issue,
again, Your Honor,
perhaps declare it unconstitutional as applied. And I don't think that's what the government wants.
Well,
right?
Obviously, it's the government's view that 921G1 is applicable to Mr. Schrader, and it's constitutional as applied to Mr. Schrader. And the same considerations that make it constitutional as a categorical matter also make it constitutional in Mr. Schrader's case. The issue of the kind
you're
of
not,
remedy
you're not
that.
Dealing with my question.
Well, Your Honor, the issue of the kind of remedy and whether the Attorney General could affect various reorganizations within the Department of Justice isn't something that's been raised at any stage of the proceedings. It's obviously a complicated question.
Can you suggest something else we could consider if our use of 925C in some way doesn't work? Is there anything you can suggest to us that we can look at if we think there's a constitutional problem here to avoid declaring it unconstitutional as applied?
Well, I guess, Your Honor, part of the difficulty is that in the as-applied challenge, Mr. Schrader has to somehow show that he's different from the kinds, there's something about him that's different from the kinds of people to whom this is appropriately applied. And
now
he hasn't.
Back to saying it's not unconstitutional as applied.
Well,
all my
just,
questions were based on the assumption that it is. Can we avoid the problem?
But again, he just hasn't offered any circumstances.
Thank you. Did counsel have any more time? You can take 2 more minutes if you'd like it.
Thank you, Your Honors. I believe the difference between our positions is that we offer a limiting principle. I'm not sure I heard one from the government. And our limiting principle as a constitutional matter is this, and it's located throughout our briefs, and we submit that aggravated crimes that have some factor that show a danger to the public, that would show that there's a particularized risk of harm by the claimant, can in fact lead to a perfectly constitutional disarmament of the person. However, if the crime is not aggravated, if it's in the lower range of ordinary fisticuffs and things that were long ago, then at that point the Second Amendment does protect people, because what we know from virtually every decision that we've gotten out of various challenges to various parts of 922 is that courts throughout the country look to see whether or not there's a particularized risk of harm, whether there's been some kind
of
finding.
But if we don't accept your interpretation of the statute, how do we get where you want us to get? How do we get there? If we can't interpret the statute to exclude common law misdemeanors,
that's right.
How do we get where you want us to be?
Well, if the statute covers this act and we have only the constitutional issue, then we would submit that the government has not shown that as applied to people in these particular circumstances, It is substantially related to any sort of compelling interest. There's no narrow tailoring. There are a host of options that Congress can...
But we can't possibly decide any of that on this record. Because we don't have any evidentiary record here. I mean, if you're going to be concentrating on the particular circumstances of Mr. Schrader, then there has to be an evidentiary hearing to find out, in fact, what really occurred back in 1968 and what his circumstances are from that point forward, and all we have are allegations.
Your Honor, we do have a record. We submitted a declarations and a motion for summary judgment. And for example, we have on we can compare pages 50 and 59 of the joint appendix. We made the following allegation, which was verified by declaration. Following a tour of Vietnam, Plaintiff Schrader was honorably discharged from the Navy. He has not had any further police encounters, save for one traffic infraction, and of course his interactions relating to this case. And the response we got from the government was, and I'm quoting the response from the government on their opposition to our facts, was, and I'm quoting here, the facts in this paragraph are immaterial. The federal firearms provisions apply to veterans and non-veterans alike, as well as to people with more or less frequent or extensive police encounters than Plaintiff Schrader. The only material fact is Plaintiff Schrader's admitted offense and record of conviction. That was the position that the government took below. Now, they had the option under Rule 56F to take discovery in response to a summary judgment motion if they wanted to develop the factual record.
The district court agreed with the government.
That's true. The district court agreed with the government, but the government has taken the position.
But the posture of the case is such that since the district court agreed with the government's position about what was material, and since I have grave doubt whether you even raised the issue regarding his particular circumstances, the best that you can hope for is a remand for an evidentiary hearing.
If that is what the court wishes to do, then that is perhaps what should occur. And with respect to Judge Tatel's line of questioning about 925C, I think that perhaps the court is onto something there. 925C does, in fact, contemplate the sort of understanding that while it's appropriate to have a broad rule such as 922G1, there are going to be factual circumstances where never mind the constitutional issue. Even Congress would not choose to disarm people who might literally fit within the application of that rule if, in fact, we're going to interpret the statute in that manner. And so a remand to have further factual proceedings, although we submit that the facts are well known and the government should be held to its position earlier in the case that the facts are unimportant, all the same, perhaps that might be the appropriate way to go. The only thing I The only thing I would like to stress here, Your Honors, is that to the extent that there is a constitutional dispute here, we suggest that aggravation is a limiting principle here, and this is not a complete challenge to all 922G1 applications.
Thank you
very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case is submitted.